Blog Talk Radio.
I was expecting to hear chickens. I think they've flown the coop. Oh, my goodness. Welcome one, welcome all to Eerie House Radio. I'm Dale K from Spook Show and Eerie House, I suppose. And I'm here with Professor Feather of Psycho Cinema. Welcome, Professor.
Hey, hey, how's it going?
Hey, it is going great. I've been dying to do this show for a long, long time. And as you mentioned in the chat, and as I think a lot of us feel, this movie, Bride of Frankenstein, perhaps the greatest horror film of all time, certainly the greatest classic horror film, I think.
I have to agree with that.
And well worthy of, yep, and well worthy of discussion. But before I get into that, I'm also thrilled to announce that Eerie House Television will launch, hurled out into the void. Eerie House Television begins next Friday at 7 p.m. Friday, Sept. 2nd, 7 p.m. Eastern, or Beastern, perhaps. And that's, I'm just thrilled to death, thrilled to death. But let's get to the topic at hand, shall we? Professor, I came up with a short list of things that I've learned from watching the film Bride of Frankenstein. I mean, first of all, it's a great film, directed by one of the best of all time, James Whale. It stars the inimitable Boris Karloff, Colin Clive, Valerie Hobson as Elizabeth, the actual bride of the Dr. Frankenstein, Ernest Thesiger as Dr. Pretorius, and even Dwight Fry returns not as the assistant, but as Carl. Carl. And what a great film it was. I mean,
and Elsa, you didn't mention Elsa.
Elsa Lancaster playing two roles, and much like the original Frankenstein, where Karloff was not given credit, but was, you know, the monster was portrayed by question mark. The monster Bride of Frankenstein was also credited as a question mark in the original release of Bride of Frankenstein. But she also plays Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, the author of the original novel Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me, because I'd be remiss.
And part of that menage a trois there going on.
Oh, yes, with Lord Byron and her husband, Perfy.
Yes.
Perfy. And we'll get into that reference a little bit later on as well. Another interesting thing about the film before I start my short list is I would also hazard to guess it is probably the greatest sequel of all time. Some would argue Godfather 2, but this film actually surpasses the original, which is not an easy feat, much like Godfather movies. I don't know, James Whale did not want it to be exactly the same, even though he also directed the first. I think originally they planned it to be kind of a spoof. And more humorous than it was. There's some humorous moments, but I think he succeeded in making it different and better than the original. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's definitely the best sequel ever made, and just everything about it is just really good. And you're talking about Elsa. Her makeup is some of the best around.
I was doing some research and somebody actually wrote down she never really looked better than she did in this film.
That's absolutely true. Especially as the bride.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, she looks way better as the bride as she does as Mary. But she still looks pretty good as Mary even.
Yeah, and that kind of segues into one of the things I learned is that beauty is only skin deep. There's something oddly attractive about her as the monster. I mean, outside of the scars and the peculiar hairdo, perhaps the first beehive. I've heard it described as a skunk-striped beehive.
And that's true. Only you know, she does kind of you know, and beauty is skin deep with her. That's for sure. Her rejection at the end there is, you know, very pathos.
It was a heartbreak to Boris as the monster. And,
yes.
And another thing I've learned is to question who really is the monster. In the first film, Frankenstein was more malevolent, still kind of innocent as a child in a way, like when he murdered the little girl simply because he ran out of flowers to throw in the water and followed the next logical progression. Let's see if she floats. Hey, nope, didn't work out. Sorry, too bad. Kid, you lose. You didn't feel the pathos that you did in Bride of Frankenstein. You really felt sorry for him, and you start to wonder who's more the monster, him or his creators.
Exactly.
Plural.
Yes.
Plural, because Dr. Pretorius really drove the whole idea of creating the monster.
That's true. And then you bring in, you know, and the other monster is Fritz.
In the first film, yeah, absolutely.
In the first
because
film.
Because he, which, of course, that's our boy, Dwight.
Yes.
Really antagonized the monster and brought out the worst in him by, you know, early in his creation by mistreating him.
Yes, yes.
Rather horribly. So yeah, there's another lesson to be learned. Don't mess with kids, man. They'll turn into monsters on you, and we see that in society every day, don't we?
Well, you do see the change in Bride. The monster becomes more human, and he becomes more calculating too.
Yeah, he in turn learns a lot from the people around him. There's just so much to learn from this film in his discovery of the world around him. He learns, of course, at the end that the person you love doesn't necessarily love you back, as I have found in my personal life.
There's a good lesson right there.
Yeah, doesn't always love you back. It's true, and those things happen in real life as well. Another lesson learned, we discussed Dr. Pretorius and how he seduced the monster into persuading Frankenstein into creating the mate in the first place. One of the things I learned is your mentor, your teachers, are not always your friend. They're not always your best bud. They don't always have your best interests at heart.
Right.
Dr. Pretorius was not a good person in this film.
You're right. I think I kind of learned that lesson too when I watching the movie, and you know that people have hidden agendas, and you can't always trust what they do. Of course, the first time I ever saw the movie, I didn't. The only lesson I learned was, oh my goodness, this is great. There's great stuff out there. I'll tell you a little story here. Just let me interject this. I watched this movie in 1958. Yes, I was alive. I was 8 years old in 1958, so I'm ancient. I watched it on WISH Channel 8 out of Indianapolis, Indiana. I lived in Muncie, Indiana. And I was 8 years old, and a horror host by the name of Selwyn came on.
Huh.
And I was privy to watching Selwyn from the day he started until the day he stopped, and watched every iteration of his shows, and I saw every classic horror movie was introduced through Selwyn at 11:15 on Friday nights, and he usually had a double feature. And I saw Frankenstein, Dracula, The Wolfman, but I remember distinctly watching, and when I watched Frankenstein, and a couple weeks later I watched The Bride. And even at 8 years old, I went, this is such a great, great movie.
What a great time, because that had to be around the time that the Shock Package was probably first released to that area.
It was. The Shock Package was released in 1957, and Indianapolis, you know, picked it up in 58. It was like late in 58 when Selwyn started. But I mean, I remember it as if it was yesterday. We had one of those couches that pulls out into a bed, and we would pull that bed out. I had two older brothers. We would pull that bed out. My mom would make popcorn and fudge, and we would sit there, you know, on Friday nights and watch the horror movies and, you know, watch all of the good classic horror movies.
Wow.
So my upbringing is, you know, goes way back in the horror hosting realm.
What great
and I,
memories.
You know, even back then, I watched him and I said, boy, would I like to do that someday.
And here you are.
And here I are.
Here I are. I'm not quite as silver-backed as yourself, but yeah, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. And I was roughly the same age you were when I was first exposed to Bride of Frankenstein. I believe my first viewing would have been on Big Chuck and Houlihan in the late 60s. And they were running the Universal films, I think, in order, as I recall, the original Frankenstein films. And it just really, really exciting to watch it for the first time, especially when you've only heard about it. You get excited about it. And then when you see it, it just, like, surpasses all your expectations.
Oh, I thought so. I that's why I said after the first time I saw it, it became one of my all-time favorite movies. That I probably can't even count how many times I've seen it over the years.
It's up there, like, with King Kong with me. It's one of those films that I cannot watch enough. Could I watch it every day? Probably not, but maybe once a week or at least once a month and still enjoy it thoroughly. You know, we talked about Elsa Lancaster and how she may have never looked better, and that's two more. It touches on two more things that I've learned, and in some cases relearned, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Because where some people would maybe look at the bride and go, God, that's, you know, she's hideous or whatever. But much like Karloff's monster, I thought she was beautiful.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own view, I think, on what beauty is. And another part of that segues into the next lesson is love is blind. No, I think we can shade ourselves from imperfections with the things that we love. I mean, look at it. We guys like you and me, we love horror, even though horror is in real life, it's not necessarily a good thing. We see we read the newspapers, we see the television, we see news feeds, and the real life horrors are not easy to look at, but the fun, the pretend horrors, the movie and television horrors that are made for entertainment purposes are fun to watch. And I think we blind ourselves, maybe deliberately to some degree, of people's imperfections. You know, I've always had this saying, is you like the people that you like not in spite of their faults, but because of their faults. The things that make them less than perfect is what you enjoy about them sometimes the most.
Or at least makes them more interesting.
Well, yeah, and that's what I mean by that. It colors their personality. It makes them who they are.
Right. That's absolutely true.
And since love is blind, one of the other things I learned is that the blind can sometimes see things better than sighted people, and you know what I'm referring to with respect to this film.
Yes, absolutely.
Probably the warmest part of the film, is the scene in the hut with the hermit.
And that's the scene when I was a young lad, and when I first saw that. I mean, that scene just really grabbed me. And there again, and what you were saying, kind of lessons learned. You know, it's that, you know, here again, this he had no prejudice, you know, mainly because he couldn't see. But that was, you know, there again, that's kind of, you're going, you know, that in a way, you know, you learn, well, you need to be blind in a certain way, you know, and that, mm-hmm. that can make something else, you know, make another aspect of your personality come forth. But I think that's one of my all-time favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah, talking about mine as well. I mean, he hears that hermit first playing, you know, Ave Maria on the violin. So the monster is moved by the beauty of the music, and so he becomes curious, although very tentative because his relationships with people haven't been so good up to that point.
Right.
But the blind man sees him as a potential friend, assumes that he's a mute at that point, and a, you know, a challenged person such as himself, and offers to help him by offering him food, a cigar, you know, the opportunity to listen to more music.
And then the monster's response, you know.
How could you not be moved by that tear rolling down his face?
Oh, yeah, and that's why I said, even as an 8-year-old kid, I mean, that just really struck me as you know. And there again, I think that's, you know, what you said, you know, learning lessons. That was a lesson I kind of learned, you know, never unconsciously. You know, I wouldn't have formulated it at that time as any kind of lesson learned, but that, yeah. And there, that comes back, you know, you don't always judge the book by its cover.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that the music initially drew them together draws yet another lesson, is per the poet and playwright William Congreve, who gave us the infamous or famous quote, "Music hath charms to soothe the savage breast." Yes, it's breast. It's not beast.
It's breast. Yes.
It is breast. Breasts are important, and so is music. And it's something I talked about many times on this show and on the previous version of this show, is how important music is to a film. And Franz Waxman did such a wonderful job.
Oh yeah,
putting the soundtrack together. I think it was used in it was reused later in one of the serials, and the name escapes me. I can't remember if it's Rocket Rangers or one of those, but they actually used it
right.
Again. And I mean, he had marches in it. He had a lot of, and if you think about it, 1935 wasn't really too far into the talkies, where we actually had sound in film. You know, sound in film was only about maybe 6 or 7 years old at that point.
Right.
And technology didn't move at the speed it does today. So hands off to Franz Waxman for bringing us a wonderful soundtrack. I actually listen to it in my car from time to time.
Yeah, I know, because I think it's brilliant. I think it's really good.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, you know, music is an integral part of just about any film. And what I like these days is I like music, and then I like the lack of music. Sometimes I think music can kind of create false emotions that I would rather have the visual create within me. And that's not to you know, denigrate any of the really great film scores that are out there. But
no,
I
have to agree.
It's,
I think
it's
what
used,
you're saying,
it's not used all that good.
Yeah, it's like anything else. Sometimes less is more, and for
exactly.
certain scenes,
exactly.
dead silence can be absolutely chilling. Absolutely
yes.
chilling.
Yes.
And no, you're absolutely right there. Sometimes the lack of, and again, that comes to excellent filmmaking, is knowing when to and when not to do certain things. be it a special effect or be it the music. Absolutely.
Right.
Another thing I learned, and you relearn it throughout the Frankenstein series, is you can't keep a good monster down. I mean, you think at the end of the first film, you figure he died in the windmill when it burned down, along with the doctor, who took a flying fall off of one of the windmill's arms, somewhat comically, I think. But throughout Frankenstein monster's career, he dies at the end. But it happens to him a couple times. I think in Bride, they assume he's dead, and the father of the little girl that was drowned in the lake in the first film wants to see his bones before he can rest, before he can feel justified, before he can feel safe. And unfortunately finds the monster and is killed. And that brings us to another lesson learned: to look before you leap. Because his wife thinks that her husband's coming up from under the ground and pulls to help him up and finds it's the monster, and she becomes the next victim. But you also want to look before you leap to conclusions, too, because, again, Dr. Pretorius is not the good guy, not at all. In fact, there's some Faustian moments, I think, in Bride of Frankenstein, too, with respect to his relationship to Dr. Frankenstein. If you recall the scene where he's showing the doctor his, I don't know, I guess you can almost call them homunculi, his little miniature people that he created.
Yes.
And I'll never forget the one scene where he said, "This next one is the very devil. Very bizarre, this little chap. There's a certain resemblance to me, don't you think? Or do I flatter myself?"
Yes.
And in a way, at that point, he's revealing himself to the doctor. I am Satan. I am the devil.
Yeah, that's what I always took. Well, that also brings up another point, too, that was kind of unique. It's the sense of humor in this movie that is, mostly through the early parts. And with Pretorius, he has there's a certain sense of humor that I think Wales kind of interjected into the whole thing, which was kind of odd for the time.
Well, very odd for the film, too. One of the things, besides Una O'Connor's reactions, because she's kind of a quirky character.
She's great.
Was Pretorius said more than once to different things, "It's my only vice." He was talking about gin. He was talking about cigars.
Yes.
"It's my only vice." I thought that was kind of humorous. And I would bet in a subtle way that was very deliberate by James Whale.
Oh, I think so, too. No, I think so, too. I think there's a lot of subtle things that he interjected into the film.
Yeah. He probably had a dark sense of humor, partly because of his own personal makeup, but I think part of his lifestyle, too. For those of you that don't know what I'm referring to, is James Whale was as openly gay as you could be, I guess, in the 1930s.
At the time, yeah.
In fact, it's been suggested there were gay overtones in the film, Bride of Frankenstein. I forget whom, but someone wrote that if you think about it, the Bride of Frankenstein actually had two fathers, Pretorius as sort of a mother figure, and Dr. Frankenstein is more of a father figure. It's also been suggested that James Whale told Ernest Thesiger to play his character like a total bitch or an aging homosexual who's very bitter.
Yeah, his
and
mannerisms,
if that is the case, he pulled it off.
Yes, his mannerisms are very much in that vein. And everything I've read and heard, that was all pretty much Whale's doings, kind of his his little thumbing at society, thumbing his
nose
at society.
In so saying, there were a lot of issues, not just around the world, but in this country as well, with censorship with this film because of the subject matter, as well as some of these perhaps vague references. I don't know if they're intentional or not. It's really hard to say. I mean, we could be looking at that with today's viewpoint rather than a historical one. I'm just amazed at how much time is going by here. We've got about 5 minutes left to the show, and I just want to get to a couple other lessons learned here. But before I do want to recommend the film Gods and Monsters.
Yes.
It's the story of James Whale near the end of his life with Brendan Fraser. And a very, very good film. I recommend it if you haven't seen it. One of the lessons another lesson I learned is no good deed goes unpunished. The monster, perhaps in a way of atoning or through his learning process, as you suggested earlier, Professor, when he rescued the shepherd girl from drowning and gets shot for it because, again, it was thought that he was hurting her rather than helping her.
Which is also, I think, you know, I think that was kind of a play back onto the first movie when he throws the girl into the water and she drowns.
Mm-hmm.
And the lessons learned. He's come back and say, no, water bad.
Yeah. In fact, that's another very important thing that I learned. A very, very important thing.
Alone, bad. Friend, good. Friend, good.
And so saying, you've been a good friend and calling today to share in this conversation with me. I think one of the things that the monster learned too, he showed just a hint of wisdom at the very end when Pretorius says, don't touch that lever, you'll blow us all to atoms. And when he saw how Frankenstein's wife loved him, he said, you go. And he looked at the the bride monster and Pretorius and said, no, you stay. We belong dead. And what a poignant ending to the film. Spoiler alert, but it's such a classic, it's hard to call it a spoiler.
I was going to say, if anybody listening to this hasn't seen that movie, they need to get another hobby.
Yeah. I mean, far be it for me to say you're not a horror fan if, because there's all kinds of horror fans, and some aren't as lucky as we are to be born in the time we were to enjoy those films, but you're hurting yourself if you don't see it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you don't necessarily need to look at it in the framework of when it was made. Just think of it as a period piece, and I think you'll enjoy it immensely.
Yes.
It's a great, great film. Bride of Frankenstein, 1935. Well, Professor, anything you want to share with us? What's up in the world of psychocinema?
Not a whole lot. Just, you know, putting out a few more episodes here and there. We've got a new one coming up here real soon that's going to be a little different than what we normally put out. That's all I can say. It'll be kind of an odd one. But
you mean more
other
different
than
Terror of Tiny Town?
more different than Terror of Tiny Town, which has become one of my all-time favorite movies that we've ever done.
That was one of your great shows. I enjoyed that one so much. I enjoy you guys anyway, both you and Dr. Tarr, but that was one of your best, one of your very, very best. They're all good, but that was one of the best.
I have to agree.
Well, I hope you stick around for the bonus minutes, as I like to call them. As regular listeners know, there's an extra 15 minutes that's recorded but not live. So we're going to say goodbye to our live audience here with the remaining time that we have and thank our live listeners, at least the ones we can see in the chat. David Binkley from Weirdness, Really Bad Movie, Purple Kniff, and the dear friend Space Pirate. Thank you for listening live and sharing with us in the chat. So from both Professor Feather and myself, thank you for listening to Eerie House Radio. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, timed that pretty good, quite by accident.
Good show, man. Good show. I like the theme of the lessons learned. That's great. That's cool. Very cool.
I wanted to take a different approach because, as you pointed out earlier, when you're young, when you're a young fella, a kid, you look at it and you enjoy it for what it is. It's a monster movie. And I think you learn those lessons deep down, but as you mentioned earlier, you can't. It would be extremely difficult to describe what you're learning as you see, because I think a light does go on deep down inside you that, hey, this monster isn't a bad guy.
Yeah,
he's misunderstood.
Yeah, I think so too, and I that's why I said even being 8, 9 years old when I first saw these movies, and I took that away. I mean, and I think when you're that age, it's not a conscious thing, but, I think it kind of stuck with me throughout my life. I think that's been kind of a formative thing that happened to me in my callow youth.
Mm-hmm.
But I the love of these movies just does not go away. And I think that's one of the reasons, especially for people my age, and even you're still a spring chicken compared to me, but you're still right up there where, the memories that these movies bring back and keep with you forever. I mean, like I said, I can remember watching Selwyn on Friday nights, like it was yesterday. I can remember.
Wow.
I remember his bits. I remember everything about it. We might have talked about this before, but I've been extremely lucky. I watched Selwyn when I was 8 and 9, and then we moved to Ohio, and I was fortunate enough to watch Goularty and Houlihan and Big Chuck, The Ghoul, I could get Sir Graves Gasly out of Detroit,
yep.
Yeah, Morgus,
yep.
who is normally out of New Orleans, but he did one season in Detroit, so I got to see him. The Ghoul, Count Scary.
Now, let me ask you this. Your recollections of The Ghoul, let's see. You had to be maybe in your early 20s, I'm going to guess, when The Ghoul first came on WKBF Kaiser Channel 61. Would that be right?
I'm trying to think when I first saw The Ghoul, because I remember, I remember him being on a half hour show, I don't know if that was syndicated or what, because it was broadcast.
That would be in the 70s. I know he did host like some Three Stooges and things like that.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing him a lot
earlier than that. I mean, I thought, when did he start? When was his first shows?
I believe his first show would be 1971 or so. He is almost exactly your age, by the way.
Yeah.
He, as you probably know, was a protege of Ernie Anderson, Goularty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Who I only have vague memories of. I was like maybe 4 and 5 when he was on. There was a lot of turmoil in my personal life. I had just been adopted around that time. But I remember seeing Tabanga and the tree monster scared the living crap out of me. The Ghoul was going to college, I think, at Bowling Green. And when Goularty left, shortly thereafter, Ron Swede graduated from college and had asked Ernie, I want to do a show just like yours. And, Ernie says, sure, fine, but don't do Goularty because Star Broadcasting owns the name. Why don't you call yourself The Ghoul or something like that? So that would be, he would have graduated from college right around 71, 72. So I would guess, and it was shortly thereafter that he started on KBF Kaiser, which became syndicated and was shown in other markets as well later on. Now, my personal
I was just going to say, he went to Detroit for a while, didn't he?
That is correct. He went, I want to say around 74, 75, he left Cleveland, and he went to Detroit.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was brokenhearted. But we still had Houlihan and Big Chuck.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
And I was still able to watch him when he went to Detroit. I lived on a farm in the country here, like south of Toledo. And we had an old windmill on the farm. And on top of that windmill was a rotating antenna. I had a little box that I could rotate the antenna. That's how I was able to get Cleveland and Detroit.
But being out in the country, you didn't have as much interference from your signal.
No,
that's kind of cool.
No.
Especially
no, it was,
way
it,
up
it
on
was
the
absolutely, it was great. Yeah, on Houlihan and Big Chuck, that's the first time I saw a strobe light.
Wow. So
they came on and said, hey, look at this, kids, look at this. And then they're, doing the whole, and I'm sitting there going, oh, now that's cool.
Now, do you recall when the Ghoul came back to Cleveland? I was in my early 20s.
Yes.
And he first started with a radio show, and I became kind of a regular caller there, and he started announcing that he's coming back to Channel 61. What had happened was there was a new Channel 61 coming out. What the heck were the call numbers? I don't recall right now. It's probably time to do some wikiing here. But I met him and his ex-wife, Barbara, at what was supposed to be a rally, and it was grossly underattended, for the Ghoul's comeback. And it was myself and maybe just a handful of other people, and he was so grateful that he invited myself and my fiancé at the time, who was later to become my ex-wife. And invited us on the show. Now, I played a few characters on his radio show, did some, it was WCLQ-TV, that's what it was, in Channel 61.
Okay.
When he returned. He was on Channel 20, I think it was WXON in Detroit in between. He resurfaced there in 1976. Kaiser canceled his show in 75.
Yeah.
Which I was about 15, so I'm in my early 20s when he came back around 1981, 1982. And I played a recurring character called Spike Who Rides a Bike. What he had done was he took my then fiance and created her character, Blanche Figmeyer. They taped her nose up in piggy fashion and put green glasses. And they did Date for Blanche. And it was rigged that I would win the contest. And then they paid for cheap dates and filmed us going out on cheap dates. And so it was a lot of fun. I had so much fun doing the show with him.
I'll bet.
And then after doing that for about a year, I started getting the entertainment bug myself. Now, there was another recurring character on there, a very clever kid, who told me that he was playing records in a bar for money. And this was a period when I was working as a tool and die apprentice, and the early 80s was horrible for the auto industry, so I was laid off, which is why I even had time to fool around with the Ghoul and do stuff with him, on unemployment and stuff, looking for work, and very difficult to find at the time. So I decided to create some work. I asked Ron Swede, hey, do you mind if I take some of these pictures we took backstage, make some posters, and try to get myself a work in the bars? And I started a moderately successful disc jockey business for about 15 almost 20 years, really.
Oh, really?
I was lucky enough to work in the same bar for a great length of that period, 5 nights a week. It was fun. The Ghoul being a mentor, definitely not a best friend, but not someone I dislike or have ever disliked. Just we weren't really close. I actually stayed friends with his ex-wife for over 30-some years now. We talk frequently. And very rarely about horror host stuff, just personal things about our lives and whatever. And as we get older, our health. But, I can't honestly say I wasn't influenced by him. I used sound bites, much like he did in the movies, in the songs for comedic effect in the bars, and I became known as something of a comic DJ. I wasn't just a guy who beat mixed and made people dance. I liked doing skits and live skits in the bar and stuff like that, and I was heavily influenced. And I'd be a liar if I didn't say my horror host life wasn't affected by him as well.
Sure, sure. You know, I respected him and, you know, really liked him a lot and you know, taking on the mantle, because Ghilardi is still one of my all-time favorites. Out of all the horror hosts I've ever seen, he still
he was ranked right up there.
Was so good.
Yeah.
But I have one anecdote about the ghoul, and it's not a good one. We were at a Cinema Wasteland, and I'm not sure.
Here it comes.
I'm not sure, but he.
I know this story.
I went up to meet
him. Not good.
Yeah, I went up to meet him, and he was just not very nice. He was. He was rude, to be honest.
Putting it politely, he's always had a disdain of today's horror hosts.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all I'm going to say on the subject.
Yeah, and well,
but you can say
you know,
more.
And he was being pretty. And to my credit, I have a pretty bad temper sometimes. But I just looked at him, you know, and I said, "Hey," I said, "you know, you're one of my all-time favorite horror hosts. I said, I respect you, you know, tremendously. You're one of the reasons why I do this and why I love it so much." And I said, "You have a good day." I turned around and walked away. I don't know. You know, I still, you know, I figured, well, maybe he just was having a bad day. I don't know. I didn't know
his
attitude.
Not everybody can call. Yeah, he did have a bad day. I know which show you're talking about, which year it was, and.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going to just say that he's always had a disdain for the internet and cable horror hosts.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm going to reflect real quick. With about 3 minutes of this bonus time left. you know, all entertainers want to be noticed. I mean, some are absolute attention whores. But some far less so. But it's natural for us to want our shows to be liked, to want to be recognized. You know what I mean? Because we do put our creative efforts into our shows. Some people are just far more competitive than others.
Yes.
And
this is true.
Sometimes that competition is less than friendly. Sometimes it's very friendly. Good competition, I think, brings out the best in both sides.
Yes, I agree.
But a bad competitive nature can bring out the worst in people. And I'm not going to expound on that any more than I have to. Just, you know.
Yep.
Everybody can read and everybody can see. And make of it what you will.
Yeah. Yep.
That's all.
Well,
that's all that needs.
This is almost over. Been a good show, and great. I got to learn some stuff about you I didn't know. I love that. Knowing that you were a DJ, that's pretty interesting. I was a professional musician for 20 some years.
I always thought that musicians were the real talents, and I was just the schmuck playing their stuff.
Well, I was always just schmuck playing their stuff too, because I was in mostly cover bands. So they were the real talent. I was just being a monkey. But I was a good
maybe
monkey.
Maybe so, but you still have to perform the instrument. Where I get to throw a disc on a turntable and go yay.
And the one thing that I'll say here before we close is, and I learned this in music, my love of music and my love of being a horror host and an entertainer and what we're doing. If I make one person out there smile or feel good, my job is done.
That's exactly how I feel.
I'm a happy camper. That's all I care about. We would
Same
play
here.
In
two
in,
listeners or 2 million. Thank you.
Yes, we would play in an audience. If I had one person in that audience, I would play my heart out as if we had 5,000. And I'd do
it
now as a horror host, because that's what it's all about for me.
I've done it as a DJ, where you just got that one bad gig, hey, I'm being paid, or I've been expected to do this, or I said I was going to do it, then I go out and do it.
Yep, yep. And if there's one person out there that sits there and says, man, that's good, then you go, man, my job.